Jim?
Sure. Issue four is an issue associated with transition. It's agenda paper 42 dealing with when is a contract considered to be complete for purposes of determining your transition. I'll turn it over to Kristen to tee up the paper.
Thanks, Jim. The issue about completed contracts at transition was submitted to the TRG a few weeks prior to this meeting. As a result, the staff did not have sufficient time to prepare a staff paper related to the issue. However, because the staff recognizes that this is a gating question, the staff wanted to bring this issue to the TRG to begin discussions on the implementation questions in an effort to reach consensus. This issue was submitted in the context of the guidance in the new revenue standard on the modified retrospective transition method. Under that method, an entity is required to apply the new revenue standard retrospectively only to contracts that are not completed contracts at the date of initial application. The transition guidance goes on to define a completed contract as one for which the entity has transferred all of the goods or services identified in accordance with revenue guidance that is in effect before the date of initial application. Given that definition, there are scenarios in which an entity has transferred all of the goods or services in a contract, but all revenue has not been recognized under current U.S. GAAP or IFRS. For example, under current GAAP, if collectability is not probable, an entity may have transferred all of the goods or services in a contract. However, that entity may not have recognized all revenue at the date of transition because it has not yet met the collectability threshold. As a result of fact patterns similar to that just described, some entities have questioned how to account for completed contracts after adoption of the new standard. The staff is aware of two views related to this implementation question. One view is that an entity would continue to account for completed contracts for which all revenue has not been recognized under legacy accounting guidance after the adoption of the new standard. Under this view, after adoption, open contracts would be accounted for under the guidance in the new standard, and completed contracts for which all revenue has not been recognized would need to be accounted for under legacy accounting guidance. The alternative view is that an entity should not continue to account for those completed contracts for which all of the revenue has not been recognized under legacy accounting guidance after adoption of the new standard. Under this view, any deferred revenue balances would be written off as part of the cumulative effect adjustment at transition. Because of the transition questions that have arisen as a result of the definition of a completed contract, some stakeholders have questioned whether a completed contract should be defined as a contract for which all goods or services have been transferred in accordance with legacy accounting guidance. Those stakeholders have suggested that a completed contract be defined as one for which all revenue has been recognized in accordance with legacy accounting guidance, noting that the question of how to account for completed contracts on a go-forward basis would not be relevant if a completed contract was defined in that manner. However, the staff notes that the language used in the definition of a completed contract was deliberate. As such, the staff believes the board's intent was for a completed contract to be defined as a contract for which all of the goods or services have been transferred in accordance with legacy accounting guidance because it captures scenarios in which measurement changes occur after the recognition of revenue. Given the board's intent with respect to the definition of a completed contract, the staff would like to obtain input from the members of the TRG regarding how to account for completed contracts after adoption of the new standard. With that, I'll open it up to the TRG for discussion.
Comments here?
Jim, I don't know why you would go to a mixed model. We don't do that for any other transition. You know, the whole idea is you're going to go to transition, and from that point forward, you're going to account for the contracts under the new standard. So the idea of any, because there's deferred revenue, you're going to continue to defer it, just doesn't make any sense to me.
So consistent with that, I mean, the way we were looking at this, we were defining completed contract using the revenue recognition as the pivot point. We put the transferred goods of all services when you don't recognize all the revenue, you have deferred revenue. As we were thinking about modified implementation, we were defining it, a completed contract, as a contract for which all revenue had been recorded, not that any revenue was deferred. So if there's confusion on this, amongst other preparers or stakeholders, it would be useful to have clarification, because consistent with Jim's point, we thought the other interpretation would lead to mixed gap, and we didn't believe that there was a desire on the part of the boards for mixed gap, because in one of the preliminary meetings we had in run-up to the standard, there was a discussion of, you know, using an 081 type guidance in the standard, and it was pretty much rejected by the board at the time.
Jeff?
Well, I think I'm saying pretty much the same thing, in that, you know, the contract in my mind is not complete until the accounting's complete. And so you're either going to get further consideration in the future, which could not be recognized under legacy gap, or you have a liability sitting on the balance sheet, which ultimately has to go away. So it seems like to me that the most appropriate would be to look at all the transactions for which the accounting is not complete, determine whether under the new standard you have a base, whether you have any performance obligations, which case of liabilities would likely be recognized. If it has to do with collectability and things of that nature, you know, assess it under the new model, and if your assessment later becomes wrong, you make an adjustment to that in that period. So that means that all contracts are going to be accounted for similarly. I think that somewhere in the dialogue there also was some concerns about the fact that, you know, if you do this on a cumulative effect basis upon the adoption of the model, that there's going to be certain revenues that are never going to be recognized in the P&L on the modified retrospective basis. Well, any time that we do a cumulative effect adjustment, something is not going to be recognized, whether it's revenues or whether it's costs. And maybe, and I also recognize that revenues are a big item and people are concerned about the lack of the transparency, but it seems like to me that we have within the disclosure requirements is to disclose what line items would have been affected and how they would have been affected had legacy gap been applied. So to me, it seems that you could construct a model if there is concerns about the lack of items hitting the income statement to have a disclosure with respect to the nature of the cumulative effect adjustment, what the amount of the cumulative effect adjustment relates to the revenue line item itself, because other items are going to be involved in the cumulative effect, and how much of that would have otherwise been recognized in the current year. And then maybe, for example, if you had a cumulative effect of $50 million with respect to revenues, that you would say that we would have ordinarily reflected $30 million in the year of adoption, and the other 20 would have been recognized over a period of 3 years or something like that. But that there is a way to communicate the information if there is concerns about the revenues never showing up.
So Jeff, if I'm looking at paragraphs 12, 13, and 14, just using this license example, right? This is, looks like you've licensed software, it's going to be paid over 3 years. So current U.S. GAAP would say recognize that over 3 years, and new GAAP would say recognize it initially. Your approach would be view B, but how would you get a different answer? So your view B would not be completed, and then at the date of adoption, you do a cumulative effect to unwind the deferred amount. Did you get the same? Would you get a different answer between view A and view B?
If you believe the answer is if the contract is not completed, then you can apply a prospective type of approach.
No. He didn't say that. He said there'd be one accounting going forward. So what? Really, I guess the answer to my question is, if you don't believe you should allow for historical accounting going forward after 1/1/18. Do you get a different answer between view A and view B?
You shouldn't, but some people want clarity on what you just said.
Oh, okay.
I think you do get a different answer. Well, I guess it depends on how you answer issue two. But if you answer issue two, then all deferred revenue just disappears, and you don't get a different answer. If you answer issue two, that deferred revenue just you continue legacy gap. If you say that that's complete, and all you're doing is collecting, then you would recognize the second and third installment.
But I said, if you say you do not continue legacy gap, do you get a different answer?
No.
It was never my intention that we would be continuing legacy gap. If it was, we would have done a prospective transition.
Brett?
But was there not somewhere in the discussions that said that one approach would be to take, for example, subsequent cash collections as a adjustment to retained earnings?
Yeah, I think let me just try and clarify this for a minute. There's two questions. The first one is, do you believe the standard says what the standard says and that completed contracts are those for which all the goods and services have been transferred? If you answer that, then you're left with the question of view A and view B. And what we're hearing from most people is you shouldn't continue old gaps. You follow view B for question two. If you think about it the way Greg described, and I think you were describing after him, which is you answer question one differently. If you answer question one differently and read it as saying a completed contract is one for which all the accounting is done, question two really doesn't matter because you get to the view B answer in question two automatically. So I think that's where we're giving a little bit of disconnect to Mark Crowley's point. If you answer question one based on exactly what the standard says, and then you follow view A for question two, there is a way that some people are reading it that you can continue legacy gap to bleed off whatever hasn't been collectible. Now, whether that's correct or not, we're hearing from at least most people so far, no. But that has been something we heard.
So on this issue, this is I think it's important to clarify what we think I think to me the standard's clear. What it says, I don't think there's any dispute about what it says, and it talks about whether I've transferred in accordance with legacy gap, basically. So I think we can debate whether some of those fact patterns you have or haven't done that, but there's going to be some certain transactions for which I've completed and recorded all the revenue under legacy gap, and I might have, for example, a warranty accrual or a loyalty program for which I have points that are still being earned out, but I've accrued all the costs. So most people, even if you said your view is all the revenue has been recognized, well, I have recognized all the revenue. And if I adopt modified retrospective, I'm going to be then running out the accounting under legacy gap for those. So I'll have a point program that will have some points in it that are going to be accounted for as cost accrual and some that will be under the new standard if I adopt modified retrospective. So even if I think there is a legitimate issue here about what – if you had a clean slate and you said what I want the transition to be, recognizing transition often involves trade-offs, level of effort, et cetera, that mean to me the question is if you said, well, the model was, look, anytime I have a performance obligation as defined in the new standard that's still outstanding at the date of adoption, I'm going to scope those into my modified retrospective application. That's a different model. That might be a nice model, but that's not what the words say. So I think it's important to separate what we think the words say versus what we like them to say, maybe, as we talk about this issue.
Yeah, I guess there is sort of the two sides. Do people agree that when you've completed all of your revenue accounting, notwithstanding the new model may have you call a point program a performance obligation? I thought people, but I'm Russ, I'm not sure. I thought people generally agreed you do not go and apply the new standard and set up a performance obligation, take some of the revenue previously recognized and establish deferred revenue. So you will have a mixed model as long as that point program rolls out.
And then it matters whether you adopt full retrospective or modify, because if you adopt full retro, then you're going to get consistent accounting going forward.
Is that how people understood the standard?
Jim, I think there's different views.
I think it might be helpful to have an articulation of what it is you think that people think the standard says.
Yeah, that would be.
we read the words, the tension, I think, comes that existing GAAP is not a transfer of control model. It's a hodgepodge of different notions. So evaluating, you know, like in the collectability situation, that's, you know, revenue is not being unrecognized because a transfer of control has not occurred. It's being recognized because of another impediment under existing GAAP. Fixed and determinable, I think there are differing views about whether control has transferred under existing GAAP has nothing to do with that. I think it, if the articulation is that, well, what it really means is not all the revenue's been recognized, then that, I think that would be helpful, even though I guess I think a lot of people wonder whether that's really what it says.
Allison?
And I guess I was just trying to make sure, picking up on something that Brett said, I had read the words in the standard to say I thought that it was when goods or services have been transferred. So you could very well have a contract at the date of transition for which you have completed the delivery, but there is still some revenue accounting left to be done, extended payment terms or any collectability not being reasonably assured. Those contracts would be considered completed. And so then the next question under issue two is, well, what do you do with the remaining accounting? Is it that the deferred revenue then gets pulled in on a cumulative effect adjustment? So maybe that would be the case in that situation. But in Brett's, when he mentioned the loyalty programs, so if it's a cost item that's been accrued, we wouldn't catch that up in the cumulative effect adjustment. We would let that run out, but the deferred revenue we would catch up, or all of it would get caught up in a cumulative effect adjustment. That's a question that I have.
The way you were reading this is don't apply old GAAP to that contract, apply new GAAP to all existing contracts. And so therefore the reference to old GAAP is sort of superfluous?
I would not have thought that you would continue to apply old GAAP because that creates the mixed model that doesn't seem to be appropriate. But then is it you just don't do that for the revenue side of it? But if there are cost accrual items that you would continue to let that run out, I think that's which piece of legacy GAAP we allow to continue, if any, I think is the question. Or if no legacy GAAP for those transactions and it all just gets caught up in the cumulative effect adjustment, I think that would be helpful to clarify.
Do you have examples other than loyalty points?
Warranty.
Any others?
Those are the two that have come to mind. I could probably think about it a little bit more, but those are the two. Yeah.
I suppose there also could be the potential capital costs that would have been capitalized, let's say, or not capitalized under the standard and that relate to contracts that are still pending.
The fact that the transition guidance is very specific to for which the entity has transferred all of the goods or services identified in accordance with revenue guidance in effect before application, because it's so specific in that phrasing, to me that meant if you had a policy of not accounting for loyalty points as a revenue deferral under current GAAP, that meant you hadn't identified it as a deliverable or whatever term you want to use. That's what I thought that phrase meant. Because if it doesn't mean that, then you're essentially saying you have to go through all your contracts and figure out what would have been performance obligations under 606 and then go forward.
Right. Well, I would read it the same way with respect to loyalty programs. I would say if that's the only thing you have outstanding, it would be a completed contract if you had not identified it as a revenue element under your legacy GAAP. So we say, okay, that's a completed contract. But then you go to question two. Well, what do you do with that? You've got an accrual sitting on the balance sheet for the loyalty program, and so do you just let that accrual run out, or do you eliminate that off the balance sheet as part of the cumulative effect adjustment?
But then determining whether it's completed or not is really sort of irrelevant in that context, because whether it's completed or not, you would get the same outcome.
Meaning you effectively have to account for it as a performance obligation under 606, if you had that interpretation.
There'd be no purpose for determining whether something was completed. You would just say take all contracts and apply the new standard. So I think the first step is unnecessary under that. And I'm not saying it's not a reasonable interp. I just think the first step is then unnecessary. Just say all existing contracts, go figure out where you would sit today under 606.
Yeah. Jim, it seems to me in that fact pattern, you know, where you have loyalty program or you have warranty, I mean, if you have an obligation, you still need to set, you need to have something on your balance sheet for that obligation, as opposed to deferred revenue where you're not going to collect anything else.
You need to have a liability. Yeah, right. Definitely.
Just to maybe belabor the point a little bit here for just imagine you transferred IP, you know, 25 years ago to a counterparty, but you were collecting sales-based royalties under current accounting practices and recording those as you earn them, right? If you apply the words as they're written today in the standard in terms of transition, that would you would say, oh, look, I've completed everything and transferred everything under legacy GAAP. I'm done performing. Ergo, that contract's out of scope of the new standard. So, you know, I guess what do I do? I mean, I would presume my intuition would be to continue to account for that under the new standard as a sales-based royalty and recorded, you know, as I earn it, just because it's the same guidance basically before and after. But theoretically, at least, that contract's out of scope of a transition. So, I think just to make sure everybody's sort of in agreement with, okay, is that a contract that's completed for which I've transferred under legacy accounting or not? It seems to me it would be, and therefore it's out of scope at transition. I can't put it into the scope of the new standard. And so I'm left with the question of how do I account for the future cash that's going to come in. It's not deferred revenue that I can wipe out to cumulative effect adjustment. It's future cash coming in. So.
You know, I'm concerned about a scenario that we encounter frequently where a contract is in a disputed claim with an owner, and under current GAAP, that dispute is considered to have zero revenue value until there is some resolution. I don't have a deferred income account. The contract is completed. All performance is through. Under the definition, I would make no retrospective adjustment for that contract through transition. And again, I would have full recognition going forward when that is resolved. If I did retrospective under the new standard, I would have to give some consideration to the probability of recovering part of that variable consideration, and under the constraint, I might recognize some of it. And even still, in the final settlement, there might be more revenue under the new standard, so I could have a subsequent receipt that would be revenue in a later period. So it seems to me, by using the term completion of the contract, that I have no retrospective application of the standard. We're basically going to allow, and I think in probably definitely the majority, if not almost all, cases where there are claims, there's not revenue recognition until some form of resolution. In those types of transactions, that's going to result in effectively legacy accounting coming forward. Because all the discussion I've heard so far is where there seems to be some accounting on the balance sheet for the transaction to that point in time, you know, at a point in time. I'm giving you an example where there is no balance sheet indication of either an asset or a liability because it's contingent and unknown. Pardon?
So you're saying you would recognize revenue when you collect?
Yes. But that's because it would be revenue under the new standard, or it's under the new standard. I have a variable consideration of a claim under the new standard. I might, under the constraint, you know, we're not looking at the whole picture. Under the new standard, if I did full retrospective on that, I would have, let's say out of a $5 million claim, I might determine that $2 million of that claim is earned. I ultimately collect $4 million. Do I take the full $4 million back as an adjustment to retained earnings? The $2 million, because I have chosen limited or the limited retrospective adjustment, I'm changing the accounting of what would fall into the subsequent period.
I think John's issue is the same as Brett. You have basically the same accounting before or after, but because the timing of cash, you couldn't recognize under the old, you can't recognize under the new, you recognize when you get the cash, when read literally, you don't get that revenue. It's the same, it's just a different industry, but it's the same scenario. You're constrained both today and tomorrow. Right.
Jeff?
Yeah, I have a question really of John insofar as it relates to the private company world where companies more often submit financial statements 1 year after the fact or in arrears as opposed to quarterly reporting. And in your fact pattern, if you were under legacy GAAP, you had a balance sheet date as of 12/31/14, and in the first quarter of 15, that uncertainty was resolved, would you record it in 2015 or 2014 because it related to the completion of the contract in 2014. Yeah, I guess, would you view that as being under the audit world, type one, type two, recognizable or unrecognizable?
Yeah, I would.
Gain contingency.
There are some fact patterns that would cause me to push it out, but generally I would recognize it at the earliest date.
At the earlier date?
Yes.
So then, from a transitional perspective, you would kind of have a one-year look back, and you could take the entire next year's collections, and the decision is it in the current year?
I would look at the issuance of the report as the guideline there and not have a year look back.
But what I'm saying, if the transition were in 2017, and you didn't report for 2017 until 2018, would you take all the collections in 2017 and put them as a potentially a cumulative effect adjustment?
I'm not sure I would go that far. No.
So Ian, what I'm hearing here is in effort to simplify transition, we've made it much more complicated.
Yes.
And that perhaps people should apply the simplified method of retrospective.
Yeah. It's not clear to me from the discussions, Jim, whether we've made it more complicated or they just don't like the answer. But not sure which of those two it is. Anybody in London like to comment? Jake.
Thanks, Ian. My personal reading of the standard is it is quite clear. I think what's probably perhaps more murky is whether goods and services have truly transferred under your previous GAAP, and I think that's where people are, my impression is where people will be struggling.
why are they struggling with that? Because of the words or because of the result?
Not because of IFRS 15, but because their previous GAAP may not indicate whether the guideline for recognising revenue was actually transfer of goods and services, or whether there was another reason for deferring recognition of revenue.
So the judgment's around figuring out what was the basis for why you haven't recognised all of the revenue.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Brian.
Similarly, I have to say, if somebody asked me the first question on a day when I didn't have the standard with me, I would have guessed you look to completion of the revenue accounting. But since I've got the standard with me today, it's clear, I think, in the C2B that you look at transfer. And just picking up on kind of Jake's point, the obvious example that springs to mind, I think, some of the US examples are relatively straightforward to deal with under IFRS because we're starting in a different place. The one that sticks in my mind is a license with a sales-based royalty where the supporting material to IAS 18 just tells you to account for the sales-based royalty as the sales or usage occurs and doesn't require you at all to consider transfer of control or risks and rewards or anything else. So perhaps we might have fewer difficulties than I've heard in the States, but there will be a few examples like that, which I think is quite a significant one, where right now I'm just not quite sure what the intention is.
Okay. Tony.
Yeah, very similar thoughts to Jake and Brian. My sense is that the key is whether or not you have finished delivering under your previous GAAP. There may be some circumstances where I think the example Brian used is one that I would agree. It's maybe not clear how you got to your existing accounting and whether or not you have delivered. But I think the requirement of the standard is clear. There's just some judgment around whether you have finished delivering the goods and services under the previous GAAP. When you conclude that you are looking at a completed contract, I think it says those contracts are out of the scope of IFRS 15, which in the IFRS world would make me think, well, I now need to work through the hierarchy to figure out what the accounting is. And I don't think I could find anything that would direct me to put deferred income to retained earnings or to put subsequent collections to retained earnings. So I would be inclined to roll it out under existing GAAP until such time as you've recognised all the revenue or you've collected all the cash. I understand why you might look at that and say, is it helpful to be accounting for similar transactions using two methodologies? But I do think that's what the standard says at the moment.
Yeah. But and just to add, I mean, ultimately, if you thought that was going to be very confusing to your users, I mean, I guess you would think about which approach you use for how you transition.
Yes.
Philip.
Really, just to reinforce what Tony just said, the discussions that I've had with IFRS community, actually, I think everyone had assumed legacy GAAP would continue. I hadn't heard anyone suggest anything different. That seems very markedly different from the position in the US.
Any further?
So I was picking up on Tony's point about the hierarchy, because that's not something that's mentioned in the paper, and I think it would be relevant, but perhaps one thing to think about is whether the hierarchy would push you to legacy GAAP or the current GAAP that you were applying for your other transactions in this set of financial statements. I.e., you would start out from thinking that this contract is completed, you have some accounting that you have to do, so you look at the hierarchy and you might find, well, you have legacy GAAP that tells you what to do, you also have a new standard that tells you what to do, so perhaps you would circle back into the new standard, which would avoid the mixed accounting.
James.
Just to pick up on Brian's point, I'm a little bit worried about that, because legacy GAAP would have been withdrawn at that point.
Yeah.
So are we pushing all these contracts that we think are completed into IFRS 15? Because I'm not seeing it that way. I'm thinking that you would continue with legacy GAAP IS 18-11 albeit that it is now withdrawn.
What do you think the standard says, Henry?
I mean, personally, the way I'd viewed it was along the lines perhaps Tony was explaining it. You sort of, the standard is telling you which contracts you transition to IFRS 15. And so then you're left with the completed contracts that don't transition to IFRS 15. And personally, I thought that therefore you kind of continue accounting for those contracts. And in the same way that suppose what you've got is a situation like a warranty or a loyalty arrangement for which under IFRS 15 you might be accounting for that now in a different way. You might be counting those as performance obligations. But under your old accounting policy, you hadn't identified that as being a good or a revenue, good or service under the standard. Then that was the purpose behind the words identified in accordance with. So effectively, that accounting, you would continue accounting for that as a cost accrual rather than transitioning that to being performance obligations if you were going down the modified retrospective approach.
And maybe just to that point, Henry, I wouldn't have only done cost accruals. I would have, there may be deferred revenue situations, yeah. Or the good example with the IP and the sales-based royalty.
Yeah.
Okay, further comments?
Could I just clarify, Jake, when you said it was clear, so on the second issue in the paper, are you viewing it the same way as others here?
Second issue, I think we were slightly more mixed. I think there were people arguing both in-house, and so some said IAS 18, IAS 11 has disappeared. How can you still look to those standards to continue your legacy accounting? But there wasn't a definitive view.
Nothing further. Jim, back to you.
So, not sure yet how to summarize this one, Ian. I think we're hearing a slightly different perspective here than we are over there. I think general, consistent with Jim's reaction first, I think in general people thought you weren't going to have mixed revenue accounting for years going forward, that is continuing to apply legacy GAAP and IFRS. I think that's what many here thought. That doesn't sound to be the case in London. Why don't I propose this, Ian, and if you disagree, we'll have to figure out offline how to move forward. But perhaps we could take four or five fact patterns sort of consistent with the ones here. I've heard two or three others, and work through with the two staffs of saying, how do we actually think the standard would apply to this? Which piece of the language do we think would apply? If we can agree, we'll send that out to TRG members, see if that's how they read the standard. If not, it might be indicative of the need to provide, you know, some type of guidepost as to what we actually meant in the standard as it relates to this.
Yeah, that's fine, Jim. I think it's a way forward.